Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Locked out of the housing market? Why not consider a canal barge? HMRC trains its crosshairs on personal service companies. And is it time for a contrarian move into cryptocurrencies? Welcome to The Money Show, the FT's weekly podcast on personal finance and investing. I'm James Pickford, deputy editor of FT Money, and I'll be giving you this week's money news in downloadable form. Canal barges and houseboats might be a great thing for a holiday, but are they really a practical alternative to a bricks and mortar home? Well, in expensive property markets like London, it seems more people are choosing to take to the water as they find themselves unable to afford a conventional property. Kate Bearley, a writer for FT Money, has been investigating the finances of boat living, and she's here to tell us what she found. Kate, this is a pretty radical alternative to buying bricks and mortar. Why are more people doing it?
Well, essentially, it's much cheaper to buy a canal boat than it is to buy a first home, and can be substantially cheaper than renting too, particularly in places like London. So when you consider the average house price of a first home hit a record high last year of just under £300,000 and far higher in London, you can actually buy a canal boat from as little as £10,000 for maybe quite a dilapidated one, but £30,000 for a pretty reasonable narrow boat. And then that's something that you own. And then when you're living on the boat, you actually don't pay council tax, you don't pay utility bills for things like water, electricity and gas. All you pay are the cost of a licence to use England's waterways, and then you pay insurance. And people cite kind of costs of around £50 a month for all of their general needs. And that's because your boat is powering everything and driving your electricity.
Very good. And can you get a mortgage on these things? Is it the normal conventional way of financing them?
Well, you can't get a mortgage from a traditional lender for a boat, but there are specialist marine finance lenders who will give you a mortgage. So that's people like Pegasus Finance or Arkle Finance. Now, Pegasus offers loans of between $5,000 up to $2 million and interest rates at 5.9% APR. That rate could be quite a bit higher, more like 7%. And that would mean that if you took out a £30,000 loan to buy a boat spread over 4 years, you'd be paying £730 a month. And people also generally take out personal loans to fund boat purchases.
Yes. So, I mean, one of the things I've always heard about boats is that the problem is not necessarily the boat, it's finding a mooring for it. And is that a particular problem in London?
Well, most people are continuous cruisers, which means that you pay less. You're not paying for a residential permanent mooring, but you do have to move on every 2 weeks. But space is actually getting really tight, particularly in London. According to the Canals and River Trust, there's been a 195% increase in boats without home moorings licensed on the canals in London. And that's really putting pressure on services on the canal itself. One person I spoke to said mooring in London now is a bit like parallel parking. It's getting really busy. And then if you do want a residential mooring, that's, you know, hard to find. They're few and far between, and it's far more expensive. If you're buying a boat with a residential mooring attached, you're more likely to pay kind of double the cost of a boat and potentially the cost of just buying a small flat in London. So it gets far less economical.
And you've talked about the initial costs and the cost of financing. There are, however, other costs involved, aren't there?
Yeah, and those can be significant, constant and unpredictable. Boats tend to be very expensive in terms of the constant maintenance that you have to do on them. There are things like blacking the hull, which is the most kind of consistent cost, where you have to keep pulling the boat out of the water every 3 to 5 years and re-blacking the hull so it's not going to kind of rust or sink. But there are numerous other things to do with bilge pumps, engines, you know, a whole kind of world that the people living on land are unaware of. Somebody said they'd paid £1,500 just in maintenance alone in the past year, and those costs vary really widely.
Mm. Now, you've spoken to lots of people who've done this. Was it all plain sailing? Forgive the pun.
No, big range of experience. So some people say it's a really lovely way to live. It's quite kind of an offbeat way of living. It's great atmosphere on the canals. And in summer, it's obviously fantastic. You can lie out on the roof and have a beer or whatever. But one person talked about their experience of being infested with river rats, which sounded deeply unpleasant. And there are also things like, you know, you've got to take out your portable toilet and empty that at points along the canal. One person said recently they'd had a 2.5 hour round trip dragging a toilet down the towpath. So, you know, it can be a great way to live, but it is there are certainly downsides.
Yes. Well, thanks, Kate. You can read more about boat living in Kate's feature in this weekend's FT Money. Now, if you're a contractor, perhaps an IT specialist or a freelance consultant, you may have been giving some more thought recently to the way in which you're paid, particularly if you've set yourself up through what's called a personal service company. That is because HMRC has been cracking down on what it regards as tax avoidance by companies and individuals using this arrangement. Paul Lewis, a freelance financial journalist and presenter of BBC Radio 4's Money Box, has been looking closely at the issue in recent months and is on the line to talk to us about it. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Hi, James.
Can you explain how these contractor tax arrangements generally work and why HMRC doesn't like them?
Well, they work relatively simply. If you're taken on as an IT contractor, or indeed at the BBC for many presenting jobs, the engager, as they're called, avoid using the term employer, the engager will say, we want to take you on through a personal service company. Now, at its simplest, this could mean that someone called Mike Hayes might start a company called Mike Hayes Limited. So instead of employing Mike as an employee, the firm engages him through his company, MHL, and it pays the fees to that company gross without any tax deducted, any national insurance. And then it's up to Mike to make sure that he pays the right tax. And what's happening in the public sector at the moment is that since last April, if that engagement is misclassified, so in fact HMRC decides Mike is really an employee or a worker, then it is the engager, not him, who has to pay the tax. The result is that many public sector employers, including the BBC and the NHS, are saying to people, well, hang on, we want to change the arrangements with you because we don't think you are a freelance anymore. We want you to be either on the staff or certainly we want to take off the PAYE before we pay you.
And so what is the result? What are the potential penalties for individuals who have personal service companies and who HMRC has targeted in this way?
Well, the tax savings initially can be very great. And HMRC, of course, wants that money back. The main tax saving is often by the engager who isn't paying employers' national insurance, which is 13.8% of people's pay. So that's a big chunk. That can easily be thousands of pounds a year. The individual can also save money by paying themselves in dividends rather than as wages through their personal service company. So both sides can save money, though the big savings now are for the engager. And if HMRC decides that you've got your status wrong, then it will come after you for the unpaid tax, the unpaid national insurance that it thinks you should have paid. And indeed, there are some people in court at the end of April with bills of hundreds of thousands of pounds because HMRC thinks they've been misclassified as self-employed or freelance rather than employed.
But it ought to be possible, surely, to be a contractor and to be engaged by a company via a personal service company and not to make use of all the tax breaks it offers. I mean, I suppose my question is, does HMRC believe that everyone with a personal service company is fair game, or does the question of avoidance only arise depending on the particular circumstances of a person's contract?
I think HMRC does see them all as fair game at the moment, but you're quite right that if you pay yourself through your personal service company a wage and that attracts tax and national insurance deductions as if you were employed by anyone else, then the difference between the two is far, far less. It's never quite zero, but it is far less. And there are people who do exactly that. They are contractors, but they employ themselves literally through their company and pay the full tax and national insurance, both employees and employers, on the fees they get. So some people do that, but many accountants, and most of the people involved know very little about tax or that kind of thing. Most of them employ accountants, and the accountants say that's their job after all. Well, do you realise you can actually end up paying a lot less tax if you do it this way? And so this is HMRC's concern, that there are people who really should be employees, should be paying full tax and national insurance, and are not. I have to say, when I've talked to one of the organisations that helps contractors, Dave Chaplin from contractorcalculator.co.uk, he says that the savings are actually very small, because if you're a contractor, you get paid a lot more than if you're an employee. So in fact, he thinks that it can even be better for HMRC if people are paid as contractors, because the overall tax they pay through corporation tax and their own income tax is more. That's a matter of contention, and HMRC don't accept his figures. But it is the point of view of many contractors that really they don't benefit from it. It's forced on them by the engager, and they really like a slightly more sensible arrangement.
And do we expect this arrangement to disappear under this pressure from HMRC?
They're trying to make it disappear in the public sector by moving the liability towards the engager. The Treasury certainly wants to extend that to the private sector, and I have heard from people involved in discussions that that could even be as soon as next April, April 2019. And if it did that, if it moved the liability, then I think a lot of the firms that currently contract people would suddenly think, well, gosh, if I'm going to be liable, I'm going to take the tax off them up front. Thank you very much. And that will make the whole area much more difficult for people, and I think it will make a lot of people move out of the sector and possibly move out of the country, because it will be a very onerous change for contractors who are used to deducting their expenses, being free to take work or not, and are quite happy to pay themselves, if you like, when they're sick or on holiday. So I think it will be a huge disruption. But the Treasury seems fairly set on doing it, because it believes it will raise a lot more money.
Thanks very much there to Paul Lewis. You can read more about tax contractors in his column in this weekend's FT Money. Cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Ethereum hit the headlines last year in a big way as their prices soared to record levels. It was a knuckle-biting experience for crypto holders, though, as these assets lost much of their value this year amid huge swings in price. Having ignored the whole thing in 2017, David Stevenson, who writes FT Money's Adventurous Investor column, decided to dabble earlier this year, but invested just as the bottom fell out of the market. David, I fear you were a bit late to the party.
You can say
what was it? Tell us what it was you bought and what actually happened.
Well, I bought an exchange-traded note, like an exchange-traded fund, but it invests in things that are more illiquid, like cryptocurrencies. It was an Ethereum tracker, or technically, I suppose, an Ether tracker. So it tracked the price of Ethereum. Now, the backdrop to this is that about 2 or 3 years ago, my 16-year-old son, who was 13-year-old at the time, said, "Dad, you should invest in Bitcoin. It's a really good idea. And I think it would do really well." And I just said, "Oh, don't worry, son, that will never do well." And then at Christmas time, he sort of took me aside and just said, "Look at this chart, Dad. Yeah, and look what's happened." It's just like, "Shut up, son." I thought, well, you know what? I may as well learn to understand how these things and how to access them in a kind of accessible way. So I thought I'd just do a bit of a punt and put 500 quid on an Ethereum tracker, and then promptly went down. In fact, I think it's pretty much gone down every day since I bought it, which is any sign, run away as fast as you can.
So, well, I'm sorry for your loss.
Yes, thank you.
But
there goes his Christmas. Christmas present.
But I think the broader point you're making is that people can now invest in alternatives to holding these cryptocurrencies directly.
Yes.
Can you tell us how these work in different forms?
So, I mean, one of the reasons why I didn't really do it when my son first mentioned it was I did think, well, that's interesting, son, you know, that kind of stuff. But then I looked at where I did all this wallet stuff and all that kind of stuff. And I was worried I leave stuff around everywhere. I'd lose the little, you know,
This is wallets required when you invest in Bitcoin.
It's the they effectively hold your what was almost like a kind of email address expressed as a kind of public and private key. That's what the reality of it is. And I was terrified I'd lose it, or somebody, some I don't know, Russian hacker gang would nick it or something. And it just all seemed rather complicated. And in fact, the more serious point is that the relatively straightforward ways that you access it as an investment, it was more a transaction based thing, which of course it is. It is originally money, and a lot of the things were designed for transactions to buy stuff. But if you weren't locked into that monetary economy, you had a wallet and you were, you know, willing to hold and trade it on an exchange or whatever it is, it was quite difficult to access it as an investment. And that's the important distinction, which is this all started off as transactions, as money, and has ended up mysteriously turning into a value proposition, an investment proposition. And therefore, you've seen a whole bunch of structures emerge, like ETNs and ETFs, that allow you to access this whole digital cryptocurrency via an investment structure.
I mean, you've given me a very good sense of why people might not prefer to hold the currencies directly.
Long list, yeah.
But are these sort of arm's length options, are they subject to the same sorts of volatility?
Yes.
And are they? Yes. And are they? Do they cost more because they have higher fees?
Absolutely. So there's no getting around the fact that if you find a investment structure in this case that is more client friendly, more friendly to the kind of technophobes out there, someone's going to charge you for it. You know, that's just the way it works, because they're going to take this underlying, put it in a structure, sell it in a product, and they're going to charge you for it. So the ETNs, for instance, are much more expensive than your classic ETF because they have lots of complicated underlying instruments, digital currencies. So and you certainly don't get away from the volatility, because by and large, for instance, with an ETN, you're tracking it, so they will not quite one for one, but they'll be tracking the volatility of these currencies, and these currencies have been quite volatile, James. Volatility largely one direction, I might point out. And actually, if you look at it, it's a classic negative momentum trade at the moment, which is just that, you know, a lot of technical analysts use things like 20 and 200 day moving averages, and when it moves below them, it's a death cross. And it is in a death cross territory, i.e. these prices look dreadful. They look like they might be heading even lower, which arguably, I suppose, the contrarian in me goes, well, maybe now's the time to buy them. Or in my case, just to keep holding them because they might be worth something a little bit more than they were.
I mean, one of the things that people do talk about is this huge energy consumption of cryptocurrency transactions.
Yes.
You know. But do these alternatives, do they contribute to that?
Yes, or they do. They do. There's no getting around the fact that if you're a more kind of green conscious investor like I am, I'm more interested in green investing and sustainable investing. These are fairly catastrophic. You know, if you were a Martian looking down at the Earth and you're thinking, what clever way can I come up with using even more energy for an ultimately pointless exercise, you'd probably be hard pushed them to come up with cryptocurrency. Kind of, you know, it's like a bunch of machines proving a puzzle and verifying transactions, and they use the electricity equivalent of Iceland or 8.15 million American households. What craziness is this? But it will change, no doubt, and people will come up with clever technologies that cut down the energy consumption. So, yeah, I mean, green-wise, it's a disaster.
Yeah. Now, we've named your column Adventurous Investor for some years, but, you know, for the good reason
that
you're prepared to try things that the rest of us might avoid entirely. What sort of health warning would you attach to these types of investments?
Well, you know what? I mean, reality, they are the sum of all our expectations. And the health warning I'd add on to this is that when the sum of all our expectations is that it goes down in price, then eventually it will become a self-fulfilling prophecy and people will just keep withdrawing. And these cryptocurrencies only really work while there's a constant flow of people, new people. If I were a fraudster, I'd say marks. But investors coming in keeps the flow of things coming in. I genuinely think, though, all joking aside, that I think they will probably bottom out. The prices will bottom out. And I suspect maybe we're not that far away, because there's a hardcore of people who still believe in it. And actually, in the developing world, it makes a lot more sense if we can, you know, make it much less frictionless and much more easy to use. And I do think at some point you do turn around and go, well, these are quite an interesting investment. I can't entirely say that I'm probably at the point of saying that now. But I do think, so I suppose my one thing I'd watch out for is I do think there's something genuinely interesting about blockchain.
Yeah.
I do think there's some genuine interest about this idea.
That's the technology that or the principle that underlies Bitcoin.
Yes, and it's all about verifying your transaction and a kind of distributed ledger, they call it, a distributed electronic ledger. And there is something genuinely revolutionary. We haven't quite seen any enormously practical implications to that yet, but I think there is something quite revolutionary about that idea. And in fact, one of the most radical ideas I've seen from an outfit called Cross Border Capital, who do lots of hedge funds, is they think that if central banks linked that together with e-money and they had a distributed ledger that the central banks run with e-money, you might even do away with high street banks altogether. Hooray! So, you know, there's some quite radical implications that emerge out the back end of blockchain, which is the thing that powers Bitcoin and there's equivalents in Ethereum. And actually, that's where you're beginning to see people doing the picks and shovels argument. So they're fund managers setting up funds and they invest in the businesses that are going to power this kind of new digital money revolution. And I think there is something in there. I don't think it's going to go away. It's an idea whose time has come.
So there may be more crypto-related opportunities to come. Thank you very much there to David Stevenson, FT Money's adventurous investor. You can read more about the development of crypto-related investments in his column this weekend. That's all from the FT Money Show this week. If you've got a story you'd like the FT Money team to follow up or a question to pose to our team of financial experts, get in touch. Email us money@ft.com, tweet us @FTMoney, or comment on our articles online at ft.com/money. We'll be back next Thursday at the usual time. Goodbye.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.